The American History Podcast, Season 1, Episode 2, European Empires in the New World.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
Welcome to the American History Podcast, Episode 2, European Empires and the New World, Part 1. This is a re-recording of the original. Now, I know the sound, for some reason, on the first two episodes, especially this one, was a bit lacking. So I'm redoing them using a better microphone as sort of a celebration of the fact that the show is now 1 year old. I do want to say something about the narrative of these early episodes. I was using my lecture notes as opposed to a full-blown script, seeing as how I used to teach AP US history. I simply took my lecture notes and created these first two episodes out of them. I'm not going to change that aspect of this episode, and I didn't want to do it for the first one either. So they might sound a little rough or off the cuff, and this is why. At this point in the podcast history, and I'm talking about a year ago, I wasn't sure if I wanted to have a full-blown script or simply use notes. By about episode 7, I decided that I would prefer to use a full-on script, so that explains why you're going to hear some differences once you get to about season 1, episode 7. Besides this little bit of introduction, though, I'm not changing the actual content of the episode, just hopefully making it sound 1,000 times better than it did the first time. All right, so let me thank you for listening. I really do appreciate it. I've had lots of positive feedback so far. If you would like to help us out, support the show, one of the things that you can do, just to go over to iTunes and give us a review or a rating. And you can also go to our website, theamericanhistorypodcast.com, sign up for our email updates. That way you know when episodes are coming out. We're also going to do some special stuff with our listeners who subscribe to the email, so let me encourage you to do that. Finally, another way is that if you're an Amazon purchaser like myself, you can go to the website, and wherever you see the Amazon buttons or the ads or even our list of resources, you can click on those, and that'll take you to Amazon. And then anything you buy, we're going to get a kickback on. It's not much, but it's certainly a good way to keep the lights on around here. And I'm just going to thank you ahead of time. Okay, so during the late 15th century to about the 18th century, Europe would be engaged in extensive overseas exploration and would also now emerge as the center of the world, at least in regard to its political power, its military power, and its economic power. This is what we call the start of the age of European colonialism, or sometimes you might see it referred to as the first age of empires, the second one starting in the late 19th century with the scramble for Africa and ending in the wake of the Second World War. So a question that we should address is why? Why did Europe suddenly become so interested in the rest of the world, and why did it come to dominate the world? We probably could make a whole podcast series just around that question. And not just one episode, but numerous episodes, of course. But first of all, the emerging nation states in Europe at this time began seeking power in their competition against their rivals. Competition was fierce in the 15th century, but would become even more so with the addition of a religious component, thanks to the Protestant Reformation. That would make it, to some extent, a rivalry between Protestant and Catholic nations. Although sometimes you also get Catholic nations siding with Protestants. A second factor, one which allowed the Europeans to dominate other peoples, is the creation or the discovery of new technologies. This meant that from 1500 onward, the Europeans could dominate their rivals outside of Europe with things like gunpowder, mounted cannons on ships to protect expeditions from rival forces, whether those forces were fellow Europeans or natives. Furthermore, the Portuguese and the Spanish mapped the winds and the currents of the oceans during this time period over most of the globe, and this, at least for a little while, gave both the Spanish and the Portuguese an advantage over their rivals. This meant the explorers could now more effectively and efficiently navigate the oceans of the world. Another technology or technical improvement was the development of new ships like the caravel. These were faster and could travel further thanks to the development of the lateen sail and the axle rudder. To add to this, the development of new instruments to help determine latitude by measuring celestial bodies. These included the geometric quadrant, the mariner's astrolabe, and the sextant. And so now the Europeans had the necessary technology that would allow them to sail ships further and more efficiently than they had previously been able to do. Another motivator was economic. As Europeans became more and more aware of the riches of the East, they wanted to acquire more of those riches. However, there were a couple of problems. Often the Venetians were the middlemen, and their monopoly on trade in the region meant prices were quite high, and so they could set them to be whatever they wanted. Furthermore, after the Turks conquered Constantinople in 1452, their power in the Mediterranean would be increasing. Thus, it looked as if there was no way to get to the East without going through one of these middlemen. Lastly, the Renaissance itself was a motivating factor. It led to an atmosphere in Europe of rebirth, optimism, and a desire to explore and to learn about the world. Now, of course, this is a generalization, but we're going to try to explore what motivated Spain to explore the New World in a moment in some depth. So first, let's look at Portugal. Portugal was a leader in exploration in the 15th century, and they were a major power in Europe for the decades to come. Indeed, Portugal was a leader in the exploration of the New World, something that is often overlooked or even unknown by most Americans. By the 15th century, the Portuguese had a history of maritime commerce. As early as 1325, Alfonso IV encouraged this, and eventually the Canary Islands would be officially claimed as being under Portuguese patronage. Now, this was disputed by the King of Castile, which meant the rivalry between the Castilians and the Portuguese expanded from a land-based rivalry onto the ocean. Now, in the early 15th century, the Portuguese captured the city of Ceuta. That's on Africa's northern coast, the Straits of Gibraltar. And it's basically the opposite side there in Africa. This gave the Portuguese the ability to control navigation along the African coast further south, and it opened a young Prince Henry to the possibility of profit that was presented by the trans-Saharan trade routes. Like others in the coming years, Prince Henry would be known to posterity as a concerted navigator. He decided it would be better to cut out the middlemen and transport goods up in the trade routes from the south to the west and the west, and simply trade with the people at the point where those trade routes began. Furthermore, Henry was also interested in locating the sea route to India and trading directly with the Indians. Now, to achieve his goals, Henry sponsored expeditions and even created a school of navigation, and thus he's called Henry the Navigator. Now, it's not because he went out and led these expeditions himself, just simply that he created this school. Now, if you're interested in learning more about this, I would recommend a book called The Golden Age of Prince Henry the Navigator. It's a pretty good place to start. Another one is Bailey Diffie's Foundations of the Portuguese Empire, 1450 to 1580. Okay, by 1500, Portugal is a leader in oceanic exploration, and while they cannot claim credit for the discovery of the New World, they certainly developed the techniques that led to the discovery by the Spanish explorer Christopher Columbus. Now, furthermore, Pedro Cabral, a Portuguese explorer, was hoping to discover a route to India. He ended up discovering Brazil. And that's why Brazilians speak Portuguese and not Spanish. Of course, eventually the Portuguese created a colony there, and that was Brazil. Now, another explorer, Amerigo Vespucci, explored Brazil in 1501 to 1502. Now, he's known to us because later on he was honored by a German geographer when that geographer decided to name the quote-unquote New World America. Eventually, the Portuguese established trade stations in Africa, India, the East Indies, and even China, the last of which, Macau, was returned to Chinese control in the late 1990s. Now, a final word about Portugal. It was a Portuguese who first introduced African slavery into the New World. Now, the Portuguese cooperated with certain tribes in West Africa, capturing people from other tribes and then selling them into slavery. And eventually, other European powers such as Great Britain, Spain, and the Netherlands would be heavily involved in this Atlantic slave trade. The reason I'm mentioning this is that often people, especially here in the United States, when they think about slavery, they automatically think the South. But indeed, most African slaves, about 90% in total, never actually made it to what would become the United States. And instead, they ended up in other places in the New World, like Brazil or the Caribbean. Now, what I want to say on this issue, at least for now, is to remind you that slavery in general was practiced for thousands of years by countless societies. I'm not trying to excuse the crimes of people who participated in the African slave trade. I'm just simply trying to give it some context. While, you know, it is a disgusting and evil institution, obviously I don't think that needs to be said, but I also want you to keep in mind the context. All right, now that we've set up the Portuguese, let's discuss the Spanish. In 1469, Ferdinand, who was the heir to the throne of Aragon, he was also the king of Sicily and Sardinia, he was the claimant to the throne of Naples, and he married Isabella, the heiress of Castile, and thus they created the conditions to unify Spain under their grandson, the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. Now, the timing of this alliance, and the couple themselves, actually, the timing of this alliance is politically astute. They happened to preside over the completion of the Reconquista, or the reconquest of Spain, from the Muslims, when early in 1492, Granada was captured by the Spanish army. An army which was very international in flavor. It was made up of troops from around the Iberian Peninsula, but also they had Swiss mercenaries. They used Italian-made cannons that were operated by German technicians. And so, like I say, this force had a very international Christian flavor to it. Now, these two Christian monarchs were so important to what would be termed Christendom in the West that Pope Alexander VI in 1494 declared they were Catholic kings, and thus wedded Spanish dynastic power to the religious power of the Catholic Church. In the aftermath of this event, two things are going to take place that are very important. The first is the move to rid Spain of all non-Catholic elements. Because of those approximately 200,000 Jews were forced to make a choice between either conversion to Catholicism or expulsion. Now, of course, they chose, most of them would choose expulsion, okay? But there were those who just simply converted. Now, initially this applied only to Jews, and Muslims were allowed to actually retain their religious rights. However, in 1502, Muslims were also forced to convert. Now, part of this is due to the fact that you had rebellions in Spain that were led by Muslims. If you remember, Spain had been under Muslim control for several centuries at this point, or it had been. The Spanish were slowly taking it back, and that's the Reconquista. And you also got warfare between Spain and the Ottoman Empire. And all of this really, in the Spanish mind, called into question the loyalty of Muslim people on the peninsula. And most Muslims ended up being deported, first from Granada, and then by 1609, from the rest of Spain. So this affects the Spanish economy, as many of the merchants and the bankers were either Jewish or Muslim, due to the fact that Christians, through the Catholic Church, had a ban on what they termed usury, or the charging of interest for loaning money out to people. The Spanish economy does present a problem for the monarchs, albeit due to their own actions. Another problem for them was the power of large landowners. Spain was, for all intents and purposes, still quite feudal and medieval. Both the landowners and mainstay of the Spanish economy and the towns possessed large amounts of land, and they had a sort of sovereignty in which they could balance out the power of the monarch. Okay, remember, this was the age of the divine right of kings, and medieval monarchs were not all-powerful dictators. In between the monarch and his or her subjects, at least in Spain, stood both the municipalities and the nobility. Thus, the monarch had a motivation to look abroad for both land and labor when attempting to mobilize forces for activities such as the Reconquista. Now, as the Ottomans expanded their power further west into the Mediterranean, the Genoese aligned themselves with the Spanish monarchy in an attempt to challenge and roll back the Muslim advances. And to do this, the Genoese and other Italians, and even German bankers, made credit available to the Spanish king, at least some of which would go to fund the expedition of some guy named Christopher Columbus that you might have heard of once or twice. Okay, so now we come to good old Christopher Columbus. The author Charles Mann notes in his book 1493 that a veritable army of scholars and activists have inundated the public at large with widespread condemnations of this man and his works. They refer to him as a brutal racist, an incompetent administrator, an incompetent seaman, a religious fanatic, and a greedy maniac. Now, as for these charges, some are true, and others are not quite so accurate. Yes, he was brutal, at least by today's standards. As for the charges of racism, I would argue that this is actually incorrect, strictly speaking, as the modern concepts of race had not yet come about. He was surely an incompetent administrator, but I don't think you can really call him an incompetent seaman. He had his issues, but incompetency, I don't think, was one of them. Now, as for him being a religious fanatic, again, from a modern perspective and by today's standards, yes, sure, he was. But for his time and his period, maybe not so much. Finally, was he greedy? I don't know that he was any more greedy than most people, and that's certainly a charge that is often leveled at ambitious people throughout history, whether it be any from Rockefeller to Jeff Bezos and many, many others. So I don't know that I would agree with that one. But before we proceed, I'll address the issue of his name. No one in 1492 knew him as Christopher Columbus. His baptismal name was actually Cristoforo Colombo, as he was baptized in Genoa, Italy. Now, he eventually changes his name to Cristobal Colombo after he moves to Portugal, and then when he moves to Spain in 1485, he again changes his name, and there he was known as Cristobal Colón. And because I don't teach elementary kids, I don't know for sure, but I imagine they still teach that he was ahead of his time when he argued that the earth was large and round while everyone else was saying it was flat. Now, here's a problem with this whole story, and the problem is that the exact opposite is true. It had been known since the ancient times that the world was round and large. Colón, or Christopher, whatever you want to call him, Colombo, Columbus, argued that the earth was smaller than others believed. And while he didn't argue that it was flat, he did say it wasn't perfectly round, but it was more shaped like a pear, and that the top part of the pear, the stem, that's where the earthly paradise existed, and it was the place that only God could go. Now, more important to the Spanish monarchs than his views on the shape of the earth was his argument that it was 5,000 miles smaller than other people believed. Now, like other members of the European elite, Isabella and her husband Ferdinand were intrigued by the riches of China, and they wanted the precious stones, spices, porcelain, and silks that could be obtained from the East. If the earth was indeed 5,000 miles smaller than what others had calculated, then a journey west across the ocean, one which cut out the Muslim middleman just might be successful. An experienced seaman who had journeyed from Africa to Iceland, Colombo, using a sailor's quadrant, convinced himself that a degree was 56 and two-thirds miles, rather than the 69 miles, which it is closer to. Now, that is where some people charge Christopher Columbus with being kind of an incompetent seaman. I think it's not so much that he was incompetent, as I think he just wanted to believe that it was smaller than it was. It was to his benefit to believe this. Now, of course, lucky for him, there was the New World standing in between the East and Europe. He might have been in some serious trouble had he not had the New World standing in the way. Now, the king and queen submitted his proposal to a group of experts, who actually disagreed with his findings, but, oddly enough, the monarchy decided to ignore their own experts and fund Christopher's expedition. So, as we know, Christopher, he did not discover the Indies, which he said he had, but instead he found himself in the Western Hemisphere. Having landed on the island that is today home to Haiti and the Dominican Republic, convincing himself that he was now vindicated, Columbus then returns to Spain, where he is showered with riches and honors. He ended up passing away 14 years later, in the year 1506, a very wealthy but bitter man. By this time, evidence had emerged on the fact that Christopher had not indeed discovered a new continent. He was wrong. Thus, he's shunted aside, his honors are revoked, and whatnot. So while Columbus was incorrect in his belief that he'd found the western route to China, the effects of his discovery, discovery using Crosby's terms, and here I'm referring to the historian Alfred Crosby, who came out with the book in the 1970s, I believe it was 1972, called The Columbian Exchange, Biological and Cultural Consequences of 1492. But to use Crosby's terms, the Columbian Exchange and its effects were so monumental, they're still with us today. The effects of the Columbian Exchange are so far-reaching that some biologists argue that these voyages started a new era in which places that were once ecologically distinct are now more alike. And the world we live in, like it or not, was almost certainly created by Columbus, even if it was an accident. Now, more on his and Spain's brutality towards the natives. The indigenous Arawaks, who possessed both gold and tobacco, were virtually exterminated by Columbus and his followers. Now, no doubt, Columbus treated the people he encountered in the Americas with a harsh hand, to say the least. However, the organizational structures and the exploitative techniques that the Spanish would employ in the New World were not developed by Colón. According to historian Charles Verlinden, as well as Alfred Crosby, Europeans first tried these techniques during the Crusades, at which time the Europeans also learned to love sugar and raise it for profit. Now, first tested by the Spanish in Madeira, these techniques were further refined in the Canaries, where they learned how quickly a native group could disappear and be replaced with imported labor to grow crops for export to mainland Europe. So, was Columbus a hero or a villain? I come down on the side of somewhere in between, a position which, if one of my students were to propose in an essay, I would not accept. However, I am not my students, so I'm going to cheat. At the end of the day, I do not see him as a villain per se, certainly not the Darth Vader-like figure that some portray him as having been. However, he was not what I would term a decent human being. While he simply reflected the values of his time period, the truly great human beings are able to transcend those values. It is easy to be against slavery, say, in 2017, 2018. No one in his right mind today is going to call for the use of slave labor, except perhaps when it comes to military service, but that's a discussion for another day. However, it would be truly brave to be against slavery in, say, 1790 or 1690. Columbus, when it came to his brutality, I don't think was a credit to the human race at all. However, his voyages did help to, in essence, restitch the continents together in a way He helped to reform Pangaea and reverse millions of years of history. For the first time in 200 million years, the flora and fauna of both the Old and the New World would be able to interact. Now, another effect of these voyages would be, in 1494, the creation of the Treaty of Tordesillas. Now, this treaty, authored by Pope Alexander VI, divided all lands discovered outside of Europe between Portugal and the Crown of Castile. The line was about halfway between the Cape Verde Islands, already in the possession of Portugal, and those discovered by Columbus in his first voyage. Eventually, in 1529, the Treaty of Zaragoza would further divide the other side of the world. Now, interestingly, the treaty omitted other European powers who then simply ignored it, especially when some of these powers, England, for example, became Protestant. The treaty ended up cutting off a portion of South America, which would become a Portuguese colony, Brazil, and has even been invoked in the last few decades by Argentina and its claims to the Falkland or the Malvinas Islands, and even by Chile and their claims to a portion of land in the Antarctic. Now, finally, another result of this treaty was that Spain had no access to the African slave trade and would have to depend on others to supply its empire with laborers from Africa. Now, while Columbus gets the credit, justified or not, for discovering the New World, the conquest would be left up to others. First in a long line of conquistadores was Hernan Cortes. He successfully conquered the Aztecs with the help of some local natives and smallpox in 1521. It should be noted that smallpox drastically weakens the Aztecs, which made the conquest possible. The result of this conquest was dramatic. The treasure plundered from the Aztecs made the Spanish elite ecstatic and funded a series of costly wars, one overlapping the other, launched by the monarchy against France, the Ottoman Empire, and even Protestants in their territories in the Holy Roman Empire. By the end of the century, warfare would spread into the Netherlands, which was a Spanish possession at the time, and spread from Europe to the Philippines and back. It even drew England into the war, as Spain launched a naval invasion of the islands. The Spanish Armada was defeated, and the fight to quell the rebellion in the Netherlands would also end poorly for Spain. She might be the world's greatest power in the 16th century, but she had bitten off more than she could chew, and by the middle of the 17th century, her long, ignominious decline had begun. In the meantime, the wealth would continue to flow from the New World to Spain thanks to Francisco Pizarro and his successful engagement with the Inca, whom he defeated in 1532, also thanks to disease, which had decimated the empire prior to his arrival. The Inca had vast amounts of gold and silver in Peru, and when you add that to the silver, which would be mined from Potosi in Peru and from the mines they created in Mexico, the wealth was voluminous indeed. So immense was the amount of silver coming out of these mines that the world's stock of precious metals would almost triple. The aforementioned mine Potosi, which is actually in modern Bolivia, was the biggest and richest silver strike in all of human history. Again, referring to Charles Mann, who, when he's discussing Potosi, he notes that it sits at the foot of an extinct volcano that is as close to a mountain of pure silver as geology allows. Now, Potosi itself, as a town, is the sort of brawling, crowded boomtown you would expect to find under such circumstances. It was marked by the display of extravagant wealth and crime that is characteristic of such places throughout history. It was also an example of the devious efficiency of Spanish extraction and refining. Indian workers would haul ore on their backs up from the depths of the mine and then extract the silver using extremely toxic mercury. The ore would be then transformed into either bars of almost pure silver, which weighed approximately 65 pounds, or into coins. The Spanish peso of the period was the de facto currency of the world, in much the same way that the U.S. dollar has been the world currency since the end of World War II. The silver would then be loaded onto llamas for transportation to the coast of Chile, loaded onto ships, and sent to Lima, the capital of the Viceroyalty of Peru, the seat of Spanish colonial government. From here, the silver would be loaded onto military transports and shipped around the world. Now, as noted above, the Spanish used forced labor enslaving American Indians to extract the precious metals in South America. In Mexico, the same system was used, but eventually Indian workers would be replaced with African slaves who were purchased from Portuguese slavers. So Portugal pioneers the use of African slaves in the New World and became the primary source of labor for the Portuguese in the sugarcane fields of Brazil and in the Caribbean. Now, in the meantime, the Spanish Empire continued to grow, stretching from modern California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, and then across to Florida and down the tip of South America. To administer this vast realm, the Spanish transplanted their law, religion, and language, which laid the foundation for a score of Spanish-speaking countries. St. Augustine, a fortress that was erected by the Spanish in 1565, is the oldest European settlement in modern-day America, or the modern-day United States, the purpose of which was to protect the Spanish southeastern territory from France, as well as to protect the sea lanes of the Caribbean. And while it might seem as if every Spaniard had no issue with the way the natives were being treated, you would be wrong to assume that. In fact, a gentleman, Bartolomeo de las Casas, who was a Spanish Dominican friar, condemned Spanish cruelty towards the murder of American Indians in his book, History of the Indies. However, while he condemned the treatment of the natives, he condoned the use of African slavery. An unfortunate result of these writings was the creation of what is known as the Black Legend. This was an exaggerated view advanced by Protestant countries that only Spain, quote, killed for Christ, end quote. Enslaved Indians stole their gold, infected them with disease, and left nothing but death and misery in their wake. Now, the exact origins of this type of writing are not known exactly. But we can say, with some assurance, that in 1555, Pope Paul IV said of the Spaniards that they are, quote, heretics, schismatics, accursed of God, the offspring of Jews and Marranos. They very scum of the earth, end quote. By the way, the term Marrano is a term for Jews who had chosen to remain in Spain and, having converted to Catholicism, continued to practice Judaism in secret. So these are harsh words indeed, and it's ironic considering that just a few short decades before this, the Spanish and the Church were the best of friends. Now, the 80 Years' War, that is also known as the Dutch War of Independence, is taking place at this time. This sees also the Dutch and the English start to depict the Spaniards as bloodthirsty Philistines, comparing them to Arabs. So having noted that the arguments against the Spanish, there were, of course, proponents of the Spanish policy, notably Juan de Sepúlveda, a Spanish humanist. Now, he justified the Spanish conquest of the West Indies, arguing that American Indians were natural slaves, using Aristotle as his justification. Now, it should be noted that besides Aristotle, Sepúlveda, who was well-read, pulled from other Christian and classical sources to include the Bible. Although we would see his opinions as extremely racist by today's standards, the reality of the time is that his views were widely held, and I don't think they were very exceptional. Now, the one thing that I've not remarked upon, actually, there's quite a few things, but this one is important. And it's the fact that all of this violence, all of this death, is being instigated by agents of the state. Columbus was an agent of the Spanish monarchy. Cortés, Pizarro, the conquistadores, all of them agents of the state. You hear, just in talking to the average person, about all the death and suffering caused by, say, religion in human history. And wars of religion, no doubt, have done just that. But my question is, why does the state get off scot-free here? We blame the individual conquistadores, and rightfully so. But the state made this possible. The very nature of the state is indeed violence. As the eminent 20th century economist Murray Rothbard notes in his essay, Anatomy of the State, the government is, quote, that organization which attempts to maintain a monopoly on the use of force and violence in a given territorial area. It obtains its revenue not by voluntary contribution or payment for services rendered, but by coercion, end quote. If we were all educated in religious schools and we never criticized religion for any of its failings, would you be surprised? Since we are all educated in government schools, I myself am not surprised that we rarely criticize governments for the crimes against humanity which governments have engaged in. And the death and destruction that is visited upon the inhabitants of the Americas is certainly one of them. Now, speaking of systems of violence and coercion, a complex caste system emerged in New Spain during the 16th and 17th centuries. It contained four major categories based upon what we would refer to as race. The first, the peninsulares, were European or Spanish-born whites. Creoles were children of Spanish-born parents who were born in the New World. The third category was American Indians, and the fourth were Africans. Now, the importance of your caste is that it would determine your social privileges and restrictions. In general, the lighter your skin, the higher up the caste you became, while those with darker skin would be lower down the ladder. As you can see, transplanted Europeans were on top, while transplanted African slaves were on the bottom. Eventually, the system becomes more complex, and you get gradations. The children of Spanish fathers and Indian mothers were mestizos, children of Spanish fathers and African mothers were mulattoes, and lastly, children of American Indians and Africans were Zambos. So what was the result of this contact? For American Indians, mass death and genocide. By 1600, nearly 90% of Native American peoples had perished. An example is the southeastern United States. De Soto, the Spanish conquistador, who explored that part of the world, looking for gold and a passage to China, noted the vast numbers of Native peoples who lived in the region. 100 years later, as French explorers were coming down the Mississippi River, they noted a far different region. According to them, the land was empty of people. So my question is, how do we account for the differences in their tales? Well, we could say that one is lying, either the French or the Spanish. However, that's not very likely, as I can't think of a reason for them to do so. Another explanation, a far better one, is that De Soto's expedition took pigs with it. Now, I love pig, especially pig on my plate. It's a beautiful meal. Bacon, pork chops, yum. I love that stuff. However, pigs are linked, as Crosby notes, in germs, seeds, and animals, to influenza. The Spaniards themselves would have carried the germs of numerous Old World diseases with them, including smallpox, measles, chickenpox, whooping cough, typhus, typhoid fever, bubonic plague, cholera, scarlet fever, malaria, yellow fever, diphtheria, and the aforementioned influenza. All of this would have ravaged the native population, with death tolls upwards of at least 50% in just the first wave alone. The fact that often disease moves ahead of the Europeans, as we saw with the Inca, meant that the Europeans would oftentimes encounter peoples who were already infected by a pandemic. A further result would be an inaccurate reading of just how many natives had originally lived in the Americas. An example of the extreme death toll can be seen in Central America and the Caribbean. The population there is now estimated to have been perhaps 25 million in 1519. By 1605, only 1 million people remained. The result was nothing short of cataclysmic. Now, diseases would have affected the native cultures, their religion, their way of life. However, there were other effects as well. The natives of the North American Great Plains, the Apaches, the Blackfoot, the Lakota, just to name a few, were transformed thanks to Spanish horses. Cattle and swine, while on the one hand bringing death and destruction, would also bring a new source of food. Firearms would intensify warfare amongst the tribes and also lead to depopulation in certain areas, such as the eastern woodlands. Now, the Columbian Exchange, a term, again, coined by Crosby, took items such as corn to Africa, sweet potatoes that were native to the Americas to Eastern Europe, horses and apples to the Americas, and rhubarb and eucalyptus to Europe. It also swapped out a host of organisms that are less familiar to us, grasses, bacteria, and even earthworms, not native to the New World. New foods like tomatoes and sweet potatoes ended up transforming European diets. I mean, who can think of Italian food today without tomato sauce? As the grandchild of a Neapolitan grandmother, I cannot. They stimulated population growth. It stimulated new sources of mineral wealth. It led to the shift from feudalism and a barter economy in Europe to the development of a money-based economy. For Europeans, it meant they would develop the first global empires. As we just mentioned, the economy changed from barter-based economies to one based on money. However, the influx of mass amounts of silver would lead to extreme inflation, sometimes referred to as the price revolution. Not only did you have a revolution in diet, thanks to corn, beans, tomatoes, and potatoes, and other food sources, which helped to stimulate immigration due to the fact that European population boomed, but you also had the rise of stimulants, thanks to products coming from the Americas, like coffee, cocoa, and tobacco. All right. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please give us a review on iTunes if you enjoy it. This is really helpful for getting attention from people who are searching the iTunes store for a podcast that they want to listen to. Also, share it with your friends and family on social media. And you can subscribe to our mailing list at theamericanhistorypodcast.com for show updates. Anybody who is a subscriber will, in the fall of 2018, be given our first ebook. And finally, if you would like to help us keep the lights on or pay for server space, then simply use the Amazon ads on our website or on the sources page. Those will take you directly to Amazon, and we'll get a small fee for having sent you there from our old friend Jeff Bezos. It's an easy way to keep the show free, and all you have to do is do something that you're already going to do anyways. All right, we'll see you next time. Thank you. Bye-bye.